This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening, my name is Sue and you're listening to Hear Me Roar, Joy's all-female current affairs program. Co-hosting with me tonight are the lovely Tess and Nicola.
Good evening.
Hello, hello. Well, it's lovely to be here in the studio tonight. Sue, I'm feeling a little bit silly though.
I've noticed. It's
yeah, scary.
It's a silly day.
This is a hard-hitting current affairs show and I'm feeling a bit silly. It doesn't seem to work. Let's see what we can do to calm me down.
I don't think I'm going to calm me down with this little bit of news, but in 1853, brothers James and Thomas Cuthbertson, do you know what they invented?
Lesbianism.
Close.
Really?
The Blundstones.
Oh, wow.
There you go. Wow. We followed that up. Lovely Jeff on the switch there followed it up for me. So thanks, Jeff. Now, later on this hour, we're going to walk the Australian historical lesbian path. Sounds quite fancy, doesn't it?
I see what you were doing there. You know, you're a little bit of history there at the beginning of the show. Linking into it. Oh, you're clever.
I'm feeling a little bit smart today. But it's with our first guy, Tess. We've got Graham Willett from the Gay and Lesbian Archives in.
Yes.
Our first male. I told Bridget.
Man in the ladies' world tonight.
I know. He's going to have to tuck when he sits.
Oh, just bless. Don't say that. We have to make him feel welcome, Sue.
So last Saturday was, the Equal Love same-sex marriage rally around the country. We had the biggest one here in Melbourne with approximately 3,500 people turning up. How cool is that?
Yeah, Melbourne's always best, what can I say? No, it is fantastic that there was such a big turnout. And you know something? It made, like, international news. I was in various gay sites, as I tend to do at work. No, I'm joking. But I was seeing it in all the gay news sites around the world. It made worldwide news that so many people had got together on this issue, and it made me feel a bit warm and fuzzy because I was there.
It was a great day. We were all there, all in sort of different parts at different points of the day. Fantastic down at Fed Square. So many great speakers. I think Nick and I were standing together and were saying that the only way that it could have gotten better would be if they actually had a legit Baptist preacher down the front. Because as we were discussing, there were so many powerful things being said, but the crowd probably wasn't roaring as much as we really should have.
No, everyone, so many big, powerful statements were being said and people were clapping going, oh, yes.
That's nice.
Yes. You just needed someone going, you know, the kind of, I believe, give me an I believe. I believe we can make a difference. You know, that's kind of what it needed down the front.
We needed up the back because the problem was at the back, we couldn't hear. So he was, and then you guys down the front were clapping. We go, oh, okay, yep, now we've got to clap now.
So you were just following the clap.
Yeah, I was just,
that's classic.
I have a confession to make, though, I really wanted to support it. I thought, yeah, let's go. We'll go to the event. We'll march. You know, marching's always such a powerful thing to do. Well, I got a bit hungry.
You let the cane down, didn't you?
I couldn't help it. I got a wee bit hungry and I dragged Tess and a few friends off to get a bite to eat going, oh, I'll be here for ages yet.
You know?
And even if we meet up with the march, we were like, marches go slow, right? What? We'll just marry up with them and continue on the way. Oh, pardon the pun.
I mean, how can you move 3,000 people from here to there quickly? Not easily, but...
Where were you?
Within 45
we were eating
minutes.
Soup. And then...
They had soup. We got to the end. I thought, where are they? They'd be around here somewhere. No, they were still eating soup somewhere.
We missed the entire march. That was impressive. That was a fast march, guys. I'm convinced you must have broken into a sprint at some point.
It was a stroll and there were 200 couples who got married at...
not forgetting that bit, you know.
Not forgetting the important bit.
We're talking about us eating soup, but yeah, there was important stuff happening.
It was a very great day.
Fantastic turnout. Now, an interesting one that I was reading about on Same was they've conducted an Australian gay and lesbian census this year because, you know, there's always a bit of a hoo-ha because the government censuses don't actually pick up any gay and lesbian data, I suppose. So this year, the over 2,000 people basically responded to the census, and what they're going to be doing is they're going to be releasing stories around things that have come out,
different
stats that have come out. And the first one they did, of course, was gay marriage.
It's on the agenda. Is everyone's talking about it?
Yeah, and I think it's on an agenda in a probably more powerful way than it that has been for a while, because, you know, there was similar rallies in the past to the one at the weekend, but it just seems to be like properly being talked about at the moment. Maybe because Kevin Rudd's come out and said he won't support it. I don't know.
Supported, but it's also being talked about by the Channel 10 television show 9am. They had a poll this week, didn't they, Sue?
They did. They put out a poll today, and it's at actually 9am.10.com.au. It's a quick poll. I'm not sure how long it's running for. At the moment, it's 69.4% in favour of gay marriage. Now, this is in the mainstream media. So that's really interesting that it's not done by Same Same or MCV or any of those.
Yeah, and the basically the results of the census were saying that around 80% of the community would consider making their love official.
Yeah. Well,
that's a big amount. The amount of people I've spoken to who say that they wouldn't, oh, no, I don't think I'd bother. You know, it's a heterosexual thing. I'm not going to conform to that. Why should I?
Oh, no, but they probably believe that it should be an option.
Oh, absolutely. I was just surprised, though, that this actually came out with 80% saying they would actually consider it.
Well, no, I think that was 80% of people considering to make some sort of solid commitment to their partner, not necessarily marriage.
Yeah, make their love legally official.
Yeah, in one way or another.
Yeah, and well, that could be through, I suppose, civil union, but 43% of gay males and 60% of lesbians also in this census said that's not good enough. Which is interesting because the UK have got civil union, and I think they're not entirely happy that it's not full equality marriage, but they're pretty pleased.
It's one step ahead of where we are, though. Isn't
absolutely,
it really? We've still got the pet registry.
You see, yeah, I reckon.
Sorry, folks, if you have done it, and I do agree, and it's great we've got one step forward, but it's still not enough in my books.
You see, I reckon civil union is the way to go. I don't reckon marriage is that cool. I think, you know, we're gay and we could probably do something a lot better. You know, so let's take civil unions and make it the cool thing. And then all the straight couples will want to get civil unions because, let's be honest, we lead the way.
What else have you got?
Well, another little thing I found when I wasn't perusing news sites at work. Basically, in the UK, they're currently trying to deport a Jamaican woman following her being charged with drug offences. She's claiming asylum on the grounds of being a lesbian because Jamaica is really renowned for its homophobia, and it would be a dangerous place to be a gay person. Especially, like, they've had some of one of their rappers has got a song talking about boasting about shooting gay people with Uzis and burning them with acid, and that's considered okay in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. Also, the basically the leader of the Prime Minister of Jamaica has said that homosexuals won't find solace in any cabinet formed by him.
Isn't his slogan no homos?
That was a front page news headline. No homos. That was making Jamaica's stance on homosexuality quite clear. So you can understand why a lesbian woman wouldn't want to go back to Jamaica. But here's the little thing that's a bit quirky. She's on her third opportunity to prove that she's a lesbian. This is a very unusual situation. She's gone to jail, having apparently, you know, dabbled a little bit before.
Dabbled with women before. Always straight.
And then she's had continued lesbian relationships in jail. But the Home Office are like, hang on a minute.
Not legit.
We don't think you're really a lesbian. Prove it.
How do you prove you're a lesbian?
Well, I could suggest a few.
Are you wearing Blundstones?
But this is such a huge issue. Like, how on earth? I mean, at the end of the year, I might be trying to take my partner over to the UK and putting her on my visa. How the hell do we actually prove that we're in a lifelong and loving relationship? It's really difficult.
Well, I mean, I could kind of step in there because I did immigrate on a partnership visa with the woman that I was in love with.
Lots of letters.
Yeah, I had, honestly, so much evidence. But if you've just met someone and, you know, if you've not had a long relationship with that person, especially if you've been in jail, it's not like you're going to have bills in each other in the same joint names, you know.
Cells in dual names.
Yeah.
But I get somebody like the head of the jail to write a letter. Yes, they did share a cell for the last 3 years.
And yes,
that means.
More than just a cell. But there's tens of thousands of pounds gone into fighting this battle. Now, if this woman is a lesbian, all power to her that she's done it. And I guess if she's a woman and she's found a little loophole, again, all power to her, but there's tens of thousands of pounds going towards this. Is that fair?
No, I'm not sure.
Just let her stay, for God's sake.
I agree with that too.
Well, but bear in mind, she has committed a legal offence.
She dabbled in the drugs.
She's been convicted of drug offences. And
but she wants to stay with her partner, who is a British citizen.
If it is her partner, that's the question.
But you see, actually, it's so funny because you think about how bad the gossip is in the community. You know, when people are like, oh, do you think she's just with her for a visa or something like that? Could you only imagine like being in a whole court as the partner of this woman? You're all smitten. You love her to bits. And she's going in the court saying, she's only using you as part of her campaign to escape deportation.
Well, I would do it too, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so right, and relationships are based on different things. And I brought this up just before the show. Like, okay, I don't believe that every straight marriage, every straight couple are together because they love each other. Like, it's sometimes out of convenience. Why can't gay relationships be out of convenience as well?
Well, I agree, but I have got one of the solutions. I once did a quiz on Facebook to work out if I was a lesbian, and it came up. So I reckon the UK court, it's obviously been right with me.
Well, obviously.
So I reckon it could be a foolproof way for them to work out whether or not she's a lesbian. Facebook quiz.
Powerful, Nick.
Maybe Tesco could use this. What do you think?
Oh, Tesco.
What have they been up to?
Tesco have been offending everyone, basically. it's a bit of a strange story from the point of view that I'm not entirely sure it's homophobia. Basically, there's a lesbian couple went into their local supermarket. Tesco's a supermarket in the UK. And the checkout operator gestured to one of the women and said, "Is the boy over 18?" pointing to her partner. And so, of course, a bit offended, her wife said, "If you want to know my wife's age, why don't you just request ID? And it was basically, it was a ridiculous situation, as they said, and it is offensive. So essentially she said, you know, your partner's a boy.
But wrote in and complained that it was a homophobic occurrence.
Is it in the tone that this person said it? Is that what makes the difference? Is it someone actually asking whether the boy, if they actually think it is a boy?
Mm. Yeah, but I mean, no matter what the tone is, like they're just subjective comments. The store person made an error about somebody's gender, not sexuality.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, the general manager of the store basically didn't say they were going to do anything about it. They said, "Oh, I'm really sorry it happened." They did give them a £20 voucher, so $40 voucher, which is nice. But yeah, they basically said, "Well, it's up to you. If you don't want to come into the store again, I'd understand that." They didn't really, they said they'd try and train their staff again, but I think this person didn't feel there was enough of a commitment to change that. But what if it had been based on something else to do with their looks? Like,
going
to tell the bimbo, you know, what if that was the case? Do we think it would have been more of a response than, you know?
Look, I don't know. It depends on whether the comment was made in a homophobic way, whether she was actually looking, this store attendant was looking at the gender, or is actually trying to make a dig at the fact that this perhaps lesbian looked quite butch.
Yeah. But I mean, there's no way that can ever be proved. That's just maybe the couple being overly sensitive. And, you know, I think the gay community is in several circumstances, they're just overly sensitive about comments that are made towards them. Oh, well,
yeah, I agree. Anyway, there is a second incident happened where they went back into the same store again. And basically, one of the staff members shouted in one of their other staff and said, "Oi, gay boy." I can see that would
That's
be a reason
offensive.
That'd be offensive. But I mean, basically they've made this big story, and this is in lots of news. I got this off an Australian news site. It's really been made out of a mountain out of a molehill, in my opinion. It might be a bit controversial because we're a very sensitive community, but I think so.
Well, I guess it all depends on, we were saying before that it depends on whether within, I could call you Lizzie or something other, you probably smack me, but that's
what'd
okay.
What'd you call me
Lizzie for? But if somebody straight called that to us, we'd be really offended, wouldn't we?
Jokes within your own community.
Mm. Oh, look, I wouldn't be offended if one of my straight friends said it. If it was someone,
a friend.
Yeah. I think that's more...
It's an interesting one.
Good evening. My name's Sue. You're listening to Hear Me Roar, Joy's all-female current affairs and interview program. Co-hosting with me tonight are Tess and Nicola, and joining us in the studio is our first bloke.
Not even a bit female.
Not even a little bit female. Yeah. Now, Graham, you are from the Gay and Lesbian Archives, and you also lecture at Melbourne Uni, is that right?
That's right.
Now, I'm hoping that you actually lecture on... homosexuality.
I do.
You
I'm
do?
I'm doing a subject every year called From Mateship to Mardi Gras, a sort of history of gay and lesbian Australia.
So tonight we're going to walk the lesbian path. Mm. We're going to go back as far as we can and hopefully get to modern day. We're looking perhaps at 10 top things. We're trying to work out the way to actually word this, and we couldn't word it properly.
There isn't. It's just 10 bits.
10 bits.
Moments. No, it's not moments, people, places, events.
Now, Graham, tell us about your role at the Gay and Lesbian Archives.
Technically, I'm president, but mostly it's, you know, an organisation has to have office bearers. It's a community-based organisation, been around for 30 years, and, you know, all volunteer, no government funding, so it's kind of, we sustain ourselves, and we collect pretty much everything.
Is there two, there are two, aren't there? Is there a feminine, am I wrong, or?
No, there was Women's Liberation Lesbian Feminist Archive, which might be almost 10 years ago now, finally filled up Jean's house. And she basically, with a group of other women, went looking for somewhere to put it all. And it's now in the Melbourne University archives.
Right, because they spoke about the Stonewall.
Yes.
Jean and Joan are hopefully coming onto the show later on this year.
Yes. So one of the things about lesbian history, there's a lot of women doing it by making the history, but also recording it, preserving it, writing about it.
So why do we know more about male histories than female history?
Partly because so much of it is about what the authorities do and say. And so it's possible to arrest gay men because it's against the law, in the way that it's not against the law for women to have sex with each other. So a lot of our records come from criminal records, court records, stuff like that. Of course, a lot of it comes from public life. So, you know, men, until very recently, had a much more public life than did women. And men want to have sex all the time. And they kept getting caught doing it.
According to Queen Victoria, was it Queen Victoria who said that women just wouldn't get up to that kind of shenanigans?
That's the story.
But I bet you she did. Those chambermaids.
Queen Victoria,
yeah.
Yeah, no, you see, it's one of these things that I'm always a little bit ignorant about gay and lesbian history. I don't really know much about my history, which is, I think, quite common amongst the younger generation. Look at me making myself young. See that? But how far back does it actually go? I mean, obviously...
Recorded.
Recorded-wise, because obviously I reckon it's gone back to the dawn of day. You know, but, how long?
In Australia, we go all the way back to the First Fleet.
You know,
the convict women, well, maybe not the First Fleet, but certainly that early period convict women. And that is one of the examples where we do know a lot because these women were under constant surveillance. Unlike, you know, respectable middle-class women who kind of live private lives, these people were in what were called female factories. They're essentially kind of barracks, workshop, prison. And the authorities were absolutely fascinated with what they were up to. And they would write reports, and those reports got preserved. And we've got access to these amazing stories of women kind of in love.
What kind of stories are they?
Yep. A lot of it, I mean, there's a particular, I've just been talking about this in my class this week, so I kind of got it fresh in my mind, a doctor at the Ross female factory in Tasmania called Dr. Irvine, and he writes detailed reports. His favourite examples is a woman he refers to as the man-woman. And she's got a very masculine voice and she looks rather blokey and she's got a pair of imperfect moustaches. Apparently moustaches come in two halves. But she's the focus of attention and little jealous spats from all the other women in the factory. And they're all kind of, you know, trying to make themselves attractive to her, you know, titivating themselves, he says.
But maybe she could have been the protector of women. She might have had that kind of role. And maybe it wasn't a lesbian, I'm putting it out there,
We never know. I mean, you know, there are very few examples of, you know, people kicking in the doors and finding women doing it. But some of these inquiries, some of those women did, you know, went to the inquiries and reported on what was going on. So there's certainly very unambiguous evidence of women having sex with each other in a way that, you know, we kind of take for granted with men. But because they're under surveillance, it's being reported on. Women who, when they were separated, you know, one was released from the barracks, would commit an offence in order to get locked up again.
Still happens today.
They tried to separate some of these women, you know, to take them to different wings of the barracks or to move them different barracks, and going on strike, you know, refusing to go out and do the work that they're meant to be doing, sort of prison strikes for sexual rights. You know, it's an amazing kind of
history. Really interesting. Did they have a term? Was it called Mollies or something? Did I read that somewhere?
Mollies are mostly men.
Oh, okay.
It's a kind of English term, but it comes with the First Fleet and the early settlers.
Did we have a name?
No, lesbian comes a bit later. They're just kind of disorderly women.
That's
what they often got called.
I like that. Now, in Victoria, can you tell us a bit more about Harriet? Is it Elphington?
Elphinstone. Harriet Elphinstone Dick. is her name. I swear I didn't make this up. She was a famous swimmer. She came to Australia in the 1870s, 1880s with her companion, Miss Moon. Went on swimming, became quite famous. You know, kind of, you know, swimming's one of those things Australia does. We're very pleased with ourselves and we like people who do it. So she was kind of a hero, well-known public figure. Eventually had to retire from that and set up a ladies' gymnasium.
So she was the first woman ever to set up
third gymnasium in Melbourne, and the first ever for women. Women weren't allowed to join the other ones, and that's why she set up this one for ladies.
Amazing. 1879, is that right?
She arrives in 1879. She does her swimming for a while, and then sort of into the 80s and 90s, she's running this gymnasium, which is where the old City Square is now. Not the Federation Square, the other old one. There used to be this big old building, which, of course, they tore down. In which she had her gym.
Setting up a gym, that's genius. Great way to cop a perf. Telling you, yes. They were on it in those days.
We've got these lovely little etchings of women in these very fetching little costumes. You know, they weren't wearing the kind of tight things that we'd take for granted. You know, neck-to-knee bathing suits and neck-to-knee gym gear with little tutus. Swinging their Indian clubs, because calisthenics was her thing. This was a new trendy thing to be into.
Yeah, well, she was on it because women's gyms have obviously had a comeback in recent years.
Yeah.
They should name one after her.
So did she continue her life as a lesbian with the same partner until she...
Yes. She lived with Miss Moon, as far as we can tell, well, for the whole life. Miss Moon then kind of disappears. Miss Elphinstone Dick dies and we know what happened with her. She's buried, I think, at Caulfield. But
we don't know
her companion disappears.
Oh, that's no good.
May well have gone back to England.
Now, when all this was going on, is it the same time that there was a middle class group of ladies getting up to some interesting things in Melbourne?
Miss Dick and Miss Moon had lady friends, you know, women who were a bit like them, including a very famous couple called Miss Simmons and Miss Minnett. They had a farm way out in the bush at Clayton. And they had a farm where no male animals of any kind were allowed.
Radical.
They're everybody's favourite couple. Miss Ross and the middle class ladies that we know a lot more about turn up in the 20s and 30s. Centred around Melbourne University, so they're educated professional women. Miss Ross is DJ Ross is a very famous educator of girls. She's interested in women's education at a time when that's not yet very fashionable.
Was it fairly new then for women to actually get an education?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these women are pioneers in different ways because, I mean, it kind of goes with the character, doesn't it? You're prepared to risk things like, you know, being a swimmer and setting up a gymnasium or being interested in women's education. You kind of, it's not surprising you would then have the courage to live the kind of relationship you want to live.
Was she out, as out as we are now?
Amongst her friends, no. I mean, you know, the we don't know what the people at the school thought. I mean, Miss Ross had a relationship with a woman who was, in fact, a school teacher at her school, much, much younger. So she was a student at the school. They became a couple. Then she employed her to teach there as well.
Oh, a bit of nepotism early on in lesbian land.
These days, but no. Back then. But, for example, DJ Ross came back from England at one point in the late 20s carrying a copy of The Well of Loneliness, you know, the banned lesbian novel.
Ooh.
And, you know, she wouldn't have had trouble smuggling it in because customs officers wouldn't have been going through the luggage of a respectable middle-class lady. But she lent it to Barbara Falk, who was then a young woman, you know, in those kind of circles, who went on to become a historian, wrote a biography of DJ Ross. So clearly she thought Falk would be interested in this book and this depiction of lesbianism. When I asked Falk about this, she just turned off the tape recorder and didn't want to talk about it.
Really?
Oh, she was 90-something at that stage. And it's a very different world where people just didn't talk about their sex lives.
And,
she, you know, was quite frank about Falk, about DJ Ross, to the extent that, you know, you can know anything.
I can imagine, though, as a headmistress of a school, you probably didn't want to be known as a lesbian. And I think you were saying that she got her companion, I love that word, companion. Now, she took over the junior part of the school, and so you had the two headmistresses having a professional, personal relationship. That, at now standards, people would be very uncomfortable with that.
Yes, but it's a very different world. You couldn't be open about your lesbianism, but you could be open about a kind of nepotistic relationship. I mean, people knew they lived together. You know, they shared a house. They were, you know, people would have thought of them, and certainly folks, as everyone thought of them, as a couple. So it's a kind of a reversal of what we take for granted. You could be openly lesbian, but you certainly couldn't employ one of your lovers to work for you at a school.
Oh, drats.
Those days will come again.
Now, I want to know about Jan Hillier. Now, can you tell us more about the 1960s? So we've moved to the 1960s, the dancers.
Yeah, it's a very different kind of person, Jan Hillier. I mean, she's from Adelaide. She's a very working class woman. She's a bread carter by occupation.
A bread carter?
Oh, look, you've shown your youth there. Oh, they used to deliver bread and they would carry it around in trucks or drays and, you know, deliver it to the front door. You carted the bread around. So that's what she did. Butch as anything. You know, there are great photos of her basically. If you weren't paying attention, you would just assume it was a man. So there's, you know, very butch Jan and her girlfriend sitting next to her at Luna Park. You know, that sort of thing, those little lovely pictures that people have taken. She moved in camp circles, which were kind of around Melbourne. You know, there were places you could go by the 60s. But
where were they, Graham?
Oh, places like Maisie's, which is Her Majesty's Hotel in South Yarra.
Oh, really?
Some of the pubs here in Melbourne that have disappeared now. The Hotel Australia was a big one. The Graham. There were four or five places in Melbourne. Some of the coffee shops where, you know, there was kind of tolerant or accepting of a camp clientele.
Were they secret places or were they known places?
Word of mouth. You know, once you kind of found your way into the camp scene, you'd soon find your way to these places. There, as far as we know, they were kind of tolerant of this and, you know, not, they weren't advertising the fact, you know, open to homosexual clientele, but they would put up with them, and as long as you're a bit discreet, you'd be okay.
As long as they don't do it in front of me.
Squealing too much, that sort of thing.
So what did they do? They set up dances. Is it like the 1960s version of the clubbing now?
Well, Jan has this idea that she's having a birthday party, and she hired up Scout Hall, as you do, you know, and got a liquor license and went down to Maisie's and told her friends about it, and 400 people turned up at her birthday party.
Oh, popular.
You know, it was a party. People would go anywhere for a party, even across the river at one point into Fitzroy. She realised there was a kind of entrepreneurial moment here, so she starts having monthly dances. And it's easy enough to hire a hall, anyone can do that, but you need a special reason to get a liquor license. You couldn't just have liquor. So it was a birthday party. She said she had, you know, a dozen birthdays a year for a couple of years.
I like this lady.
She was a really interesting character and quite sort of out there and prepared. At one point the cops turned up at Fitzroy and told her to get back across the river where, you know, people like that belonged, South Yarra. Oh.
So far away.
Okay, then.
Safe if the river's between us and there, she told him to piss off. She just had a few more over there just to make the point.
She just kept having dances.
Yeah, and then eventually, you know, kind of places started to think, oh, we could get Jan in. She'd organised, you know, a one night a week. So her dances became very popular and kind of established. You know, so there were places where you'd go every week instead of having to move around.
Hi, you're listening to Hear Me Raw here on Joy 94.9, and we're talking Australian lesbian history tonight. Now, we were just chatting a little bit during the announcements there, and I was actually saying a bit of a Scottish lesbian history. My grandmother's aunt came to live with the family at one point because she'd been a ladies' lady, and the lady that had been her companion had passed away. So she actually came to live with the whole family. Because that's what we're saying. These people are probably, you know, round about similar ages to probably our grandparents now. And that's for me is a crazy idea. My gran hosting a dance party, as we were talking about before, and inviting people and squaring up to the cops when they came around to say it's not really your birthday. So I think it's amazing. What kind of entertainment would they have at these parties, though? Are they just like a little bit of waltzing? Or
when Jan's parties took off, particularly when they were over at South Yarra, they had live bands. You know, live music was usually the thing. There's this whole list of people who went on and became very famous, like John Farnham and Sherbet and bands like that who would perform. Well, you know, when you're early in your career, you'll perform anywhere. But they apparently really liked the crowd, and the crowd appreciated having them come and perform, and they liked the, you know, the regular work and so
That's
on.
That's amazing. So we have plans like doing that, and then Countdown. We thought it was Countdown that made him famous. It wasn't at all. It was Jan Hillier.
Oh, yeah, that's where they got started, a lot of them.
That's amazing.
Wow.
I love it. Now, that, I guess, led on, didn't it, to the first lesbian social and political organisations within Australia. And I guess those structures that were founded then at these dance halls. Hey, I know this, and why don't we get together and discuss more political issues to get things forward?
Yep. And also part of the international world. I mean, the first organisation for gay people in Australia that wasn't purely social was set up here in Melbourne called Daughters of Bilitis. And that was a group of women who subscribed to an American magazine produced by the American organisation Daughters of Bilitis. And they subscribed. The organisation over there noticed there were two women in Melbourne, Australia, and got them in touch with each other, and they knew other people. They decided to form their own branch of the organisation, which they did, but very rapidly went beyond the purely social. They started to try to educate the wider community. So some of the members went on television and radio and newspapers and magazines talking about what it meant to be a lesbian and how all the stereotypes weren't true. It was really very important.
What years were...
69. This is the 40th anniversary of gay and lesbian politics in Australia this year because of Daughters of Bilitis and an organisation in Canberra called Homosexual Law Reform Society.
That's 1969. That's amazing.
Mm. We've come a long way in 40 years.
You think so? I didn't think that actually we would have had those discussions then, because the 60s was flower power kind of era.
But also politics, you know, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the Aboriginal movement. It kind of seemed inevitable, looking back, that gay people would have organised as well.
So what did Bilitis, I always call it Bilitis, because that seems so Aussie, doesn't it? Oh, like it's Bilitis. But what did Bilitis do? What was their foundation to actually get legislative changes in America?
In America, they were founded in the 1950s. Like in the United States, that kind of organising goes back to 1948 with kind of mixed groups, particularly of men. But an organisation for women is founded in the mid-50s. They produced this newsletter. There's not much need for sort of lesbian law reform, because it's not against the law to be a lesbian. And some of the issues that we take for granted about, you know, the right to get married or to have custody of your kids or anti-discrimination was just unimaginable, really. So really they're about sort of having a social life, learning how to cope with an oppressive and discriminatory society, and also trying to change that by education and agitation.
So what did they actually do in Australia? What were some of the...
In Australia, they would have social gatherings and... You know, the kind of things people were doing then, you know, like car rallies and, you know, picnics and so on. Not really blatant, but off having a good time together. But also going onto television and radio and just talking about, you know, the fact, yes, we are lesbians and we don't fit all your stereotypes and, you know, you should change your mind about who we are.
Yeah, that kind of time was a time of, like, feminism and stuff like that, but it sounds like it was all quite tame. I've heard the term radical lesbians kind of banded around the place. What were they part of the same group, or is that something different altogether?
That's something different. I mean, once you start to organise, you very rapidly, bits of your organisation become more radical. So the first group in Melbourne after Doors of Bilitis is called Society 5. It's a very kind of closety name, really.
Well, it sounds like a nightclub now or something.
Yes, probably will be again now. But that very rapidly, a gay liberation split off from Society 5, and then women got pissed off with the sexism of the gay men, and they split off to form Radical Lesbians in about 72 or 73. And they, you know, they're involved in protests and graffitiing and that kind of educational stuff, but they're also interested in sort of living differently. They're very keen to, you know, communal households, dressing differently, so not looking feminine and pretty, but trying to look kind of assertive and confident, and enormously short haircuts, you know, sort of off the shoulders, oh, shorter than their shoulders. And this was kind of extraordinary at the time. You know, women had long hair, and if they bound it up or they let it loose, but once the lesbians started cutting their hair, this was kind of a bit of a breakthrough. Wearing boiler suits and all that stuff comes later. But using the word lesbian, which was a bit of a kind of provocation, not a nice word really, but they used it anyway.
How did that go down in Australian, in cultural terms? Did people cope with these radical lesbians, or were they really offensed by the short hair and the anti-feminine kind of ways?
Both. I mean, some people just were tremendously keen. You know, the sort of the left and the social movements, they could see this as a struggle for liberation and freedom and self-assertion. They were very keen. Conservatives, you know, not so much. Didn't like it at all.
Yeah, it's interesting when groups really, you know, they strive to liberate themselves, they can also at the very same time be segmenting themselves from the rest of the community.
Yep, and that was certainly a problem people felt at the time. You know, it would be better if we could all be in one big organisation.
Yeah.
Well, actually, sometimes splitting off let people stop having arguments that they couldn't resolve. Just go away and do their thing.
Was it all very much focused in the cities and stuff like that? Or was, you know, what was happening in rural areas? You know, because obviously distance was probably even more of an issue then than it is now.
In Australia, some of the provincial towns, Geelong, Newcastle, somewhere in New England, you know, there are gay, Tamworth, there are gay rights organisations set up and social organisations. Farms and stuff, it's, you know,
Wow. Yeah, but that seems kind of crazy, because I mean, it's still obviously a problem today that people in rural areas have got more issues with people not accepting them than in the cities. So.
Yeah, big cities kind of cultivate this diversity and give you space where you can meet other people like you.
Now, talking about meeting other people, there was a beat set up in Melbourne a while ago that didn't quite go to plan. Is that right?
That's right. Well, apart from the long history of men's beats, there was this effort in the mid-70s to set up a lesbian beat, which was in the
wrong era.
Edinburgh Gardens.
Not that long ago, is it, Graham?
73, 74, somewhere
there
about
you go.
That. Quite a long time ago. Yes, a bunch of women decided, you know, anything men could do, women could do too. That was kind of the whole point about women's liberation and feminism. And they decided they could have a beat, and they sort of spread the word. They decided where it would be. So they announced, you know, Edinburgh Gardens off there in North Fitzroy.
Would love to know how they announced that on
Flyers. It's not on the internet. So it's all word of mouth. You know, they're obviously not putting ads in the newspapers. They're just sort of word of mouth. We're going to have a beat, and it's going to be there, and it's going to be these nights of the week. And
didn't go well.
No, the problem was that because it was word of mouth, everyone who turned up knew everybody else. And I don't know if you know this, but this is not how beats are meant to work. You're meant to meet strangers.
It is so lesbian.
It is so lesbian.
And still today as well.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you think it would work today, Nicola, a lesbian beat?
I don't know. I think you'd probably have the same problem. Either that, or you know, you'd probably just have one person standing out there in the cold for ages waiting for someone else to show up. You know?
Which is sometimes how it works for men as well, too.
I don't know. I personally couldn't do the whole beat thing. You know, you need candles and dinner and, you know,
you're such a lesbian.
I'm such an old lesbian.
Such a lesbian.
Yeah, I just don't like the idea of going and not knowing. And
I think in a time like that, it was probably in some ways quite liberating. But as you say, if they've run into everyone they know, it kind of removes that.
Yeah, it wasn't a glorious success. It didn't last very long.
Yep. Oh. Now, one of the I've got a question here saying, well, who is Monty Pushin? Now, when I actually read that, I thought, who's Monty Python? I'm like, I know the answer to that. But who the world's oldest lesbian?
Monty Pushin came out as a lesbian at the age of 103.
Wow.
In the late 1980s, she did an interview with one of the gay papers where she talked about her life and, you know, the fact that she'd always been a lesbian. That wasn't the word that she used, but she talked about her relationship with a woman called Debbie, who she met in 1910. They were in a relationship for 12 years, and then Debbie fell for somebody else and moved out.
Bad
Debbie.
Everybody's got a bad Debbie.
Luckily, Monty had a whole bunch of camp male friends who kind of rallied around to make her feel better. They took her out and, you know, out on the town and...
She was quite radical at her time because she set up a farm or something, is that right?
No, that was the other one. Yes. Yeah, actually, she's around at the same time. I wonder if she knew those people.
Maybe, but she
It's a small town, Melbourne, in the 1910s.
I still can't get over the beat where a bunch of friends showed up. Oh, that is just too good.
It's just wrong, isn't it? Now, we've got Penny Wong at the moment. Now, she's in, obviously, the Minister for Climate Change and Water.
Mm.
Is that right?
Yes.
I'm getting my politics all mixed up here. We're obviously getting
powerful women in politics.
Thank you. That's my
that are out and not shy about it.
Yeah, which is really nice. So obviously, historically, we've come a long way from the early days where you had a companion and you had to be very quiet.
Hmm.
We always just went quiet then.
Yeah, no, as we've discussed before, I think it's absolutely fantastic when members of society, prominent members of society are comfortable to come out because they just do so much for the community around them that I'm sure they couldn't even comprehend themselves.
Yeah, I remember when they were swearing in the Rudd ministry and, you know, the photos on the front page and there was, you know, this minister and his wife and kids and stuff, but there was Penny Wong and her girlfriend and her mother just sort of marching in to be sworn in as a minister. And, you know, that stuff matters after, you know, a long time of invisibility, just to see people.
Being a person who's clearly, like, scrutinised all of our history in Australia for, and it is massive and we've come so far, do you see a real pivotal point in there having been a turning point for us?
The late 60s, when people start to come out. I think the single most important thing we did was to come out to family and friends and workmates. Because I think there's this thing where you can dislike groups of people in the abstract. Oh, I don't like homosexuals. And then you discover, you know, your son is one or your workmate is one or your husband or your wife is one. That's a bit iffy, but, you know, you discover that
it happened. Okay. Happens to some of us.
Yes. And sometimes that goes well. But generally speaking, if people find that people they like are homosexual, then they kind of start to adjust their thinking. I think it's the most important thing we did and need to be still doing.
Graham, thank you so much for your time. Would you come back another time on Hear Me Roar to go through
with
some other
top 10 things?
Oh, look, absolutely.
We just went through about 70. It was great.
Fantastic. We've been talking to Graham from the Gay and Lesbian Archives here in Victoria. Good evening. We're rounding up Hear Me Roar. You've been listening to Sue, Tess and Nicola. I was going to say Kathy. Sorry, darling.
No, I'm definitely Nicola. I'm checking.
I think I'm Tess. I don't know. Sometimes I don't know on a Thursday.
After that lovely chat. Now, I just want to do a follow-up. I did an interview the other week with Marty Keel. Now, Marty Keel has a book out, and it's called Nature Ethics and Ecofeminist Perspective. Really in-depth interview. It was too long, actually, to put into this show, so I'm going to play a snippet in a future week. She explores the underlying worldview of nature ethics and offering an alternative ecofeminist approach. She basically looks at the humanist side of lesbianism and looks at nature and our relationship with it.
I see. I'm not going to be. I wouldn't be very good in that interview, Sue, because you know I'm just a lesbian, and I happen to be a bit of a jerk as well. I've got nothing else, and none of that kind of other earthly stuff about me. I just happen to be gay.
You put Nicola in nature, and it's absolutely hilarious. Just watching her hair buff up is funny enough.
Well, maybe you want to check out that on our podcast.
Yeah, maybe, sorry. I was going to say maybe Nicola should check out that.
It might enlighten me a little bit.
Yeah, and keep your hair down when you're doing it, love, right?
Mm-hmm.
So check out that on our podcast. Just follow the joy.org.au link and have a look at Hear Me Roar, and you'll find all of our shows there on podcast. They're doing really well. And also some great news.
A few weeks ago, we did a show on home birthing legislation and changes that might occur next year. But we spoke to Jo, who was very heavily pregnant, and we'd like to announce the safe arrival of beautiful baby boy Angus Daniel, and both mum and baby are doing fine, and he weighed 7 pounds 4 ounces. Cute.
I'm sure there was another radio station that had its own baby. Can we have that baby?
Angus is ours. I'm sorry, Joe. Angus is ours. It's a done deal.
Joe enjoyed her time on the show. I'm sure she would give up baby Angus Daniel for a good cause.
It's a good cause. It's community radio. So thank you. It's really great to hear that he arrived safely. Coming up next week, we're looking at body image and eating disorders, which will be very, very interesting. And on a sad note.
Yes, very sad note indeed, that Joy's going to be saying goodbye to our wonderful
our station manager.
Station manager, Stephen. He's going to be sorely missed around here.
Stephen's been station manager for 2 years now, and he's been a mentor to me and many of the new people coming through on the Taste of Radio course, and obviously people who have been here for a long time. He saw the station move from South Melbourne to here in Melbourne. He will be sorely missed by everybody.
Certainly will.
You've been listening to Hear Me Roar on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation. Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.